Good afternoon. You are joining We the People Radio. There we go. Having a little volume problem here. Okay. We're all situated now. So we've had some little change in our lineup here. We've got some updates on stuff for you. But you're listening to We the People. You can find us online at wethepeopleradio.us. My name is Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
No, you're not, because we couldn't hear you.
Hello.
There you go. And our ever effervescing engineer.
I'm Bob Martin.
Yeah, so there you go. You've got all the voices that go with the program. Okay, so we've had a little change to our East Coast programming. Here on the West Coast, you can hear us live Sundays from noon to 2. That's Pacific time because we're in far northern California. And then the show airs actually in its entirety, but they compress it to an hour and a half. So it's commercial free. It's on the East Coast on the Conservative Commandos Radio Network, WNJC 1360 AM. That's going to be Saturdays from 2:30 to 4. So all that stuff's right on the front page of the website. There's also a really terrific phone number. So if you have people who like conservative radio and they don't have computer connection,
they got a phone.
But yeah, but they have, you know, maybe unlimited long distance or whatever. The number's 832-999-1199. And the programs in the Conservative Commandos network just loop. So anyway, you can find all that at wethepeopleradio.us. So let's speed on to our guest. We have two guests today. Second half, we will be chatting about the First Amendment case that the Attorney General of California lost, actually, with Mario Lopez, the president of the Hispanic Leadership Fund. I think that's going to be a really super interesting topic. And then here in the first hour, we are chatting with Walt Hare, who I don't even know how to – I'm just going to read right off his site because there's so much to tell you I don't want to blow it, and I'm not an expert here, so I'll let Walt be the expert. It says here on the one article, he is the man who has had two sex changes. The incredible story of Walt, who became Laura, then reversed the operation because he believes surgeons in the U.S. and Europe are too quick to operate. And I read an article in Heritage that was written by Walt. I've linked all that on the webpage for you. And I thought, oh, my gosh, he just said all the stuff that so many people are either wondering about or think already, but we're not allowed to say. So that perfect chance to give Walt a forum and let him explain it. So how are you doing this afternoon, Walt?
I'm doing great. Great. Thanks for having me on.
Absolutely. I just exhausted all our information, so the rest is all you.
I can just go now. You've got all my information. I can just leave, you know.
No, we just got to the part where we don't know anything.
Oh, okay. All right.
So I don't know how you typically tell this story, but we're game for wherever you want to begin.
Well, yeah, I mean it's a hard story to tell. It's certainly relevant today.
Absolutely.
I started out like many people who suffer with gender dysphoria, struggling with gender identity at a very young age, and for me. It was at the age of 4 that this all started for me. So I was cross-dressing at the age of 4 and did so for, you know, many, many years. And one thing I do want the audience to know is that the vast majority of transgenders are not homosexual, and I fall into that category. And we heard Bruce Jenner talk about this, Caitlin, whoever. You know, he admits that, you know, he's not homosexual, and it seems to surprise people. But if we begin to understand that gender dysphoria has nothing whatsoever in the world to do with sexuality, it has everything to do with how we see ourselves. And then what we want to find out is why do we see ourselves as a different gender? And when we start looking at the research findings, we discover that gender dysphoria, according to the research findings, is a childhood developmental disorder where children especially children, become confused and anxious about their gender identity, and that confusion and anxiety turns into depression that evolves into dysphoria. And dysphoria itself is the opposite side of euphoria. So what we understand is then gender dysphoria is a form of gender depression. So I struggled with that for many years, and until I did get married while I was struggling with the dysphoria at the age of 21, and was married for 17 years, lived in California, as a matter of fact. And after many, many years, went for psychotherapy to a, quote, gender specialist. In fact, the guy that I went to was the guy who wrote the what we now know is identified as the standards of care for diagnosing and treating people who suffer with gender dysphoria. So I went to a guy who was, clinically speaking, was probably one of the most well-read and well-known persons in the world. So he diagnosed me with gender dysphoria and recommended the gender reassignment surgery, which I waited 2 years after the original diagnosis and went back to him 2 years later to be reevaluated. And he said, yes, you're still suffering from gender dysphoria, and the only cure for that is gender reassignment surgery. And so I opted for the gender reassignment surgery. But what I learned later, as I studied psychology at UC Santa Cruz, to become someone who could help others with these disorders, is that gender dysphoria is not, there is no medical necessity for gender reassignment surgery, because according to the research, not according to Walt Heyer, but according to research studies from around the world, including Rome, Japan, the UK, Sweden, and Denmark, people with gender dysphoria are suffering from what they call psychiatric and psychological comorbid disorders that are routinely never diagnosed, and therefore, because they're not diagnosed, they're never treated. So somewhere between 10 and 15 years, people discover that they still have a dysphoria, but now they've altered their body and their life to such a degree that that's even more troubling than it was if they'd gotten the proper treatment to begin with. So that's kind of where I am today, and I have a website, sexchangeregret.com, that currently is reaching about 50,000 people per month. I do media around the world, from Russia to UK to Australia and every other place in the world. We reach 180 countries around the world because people are very interested in knowing what is the onset of gender dysphoria, and they're kind of puzzled by two things. One, that it's a childhood developmental disorder. Again, that's not my opinion. It's what the research studies show. And also that most of them are not homosexual. So that's kind of the, in a nutshell, the whole transgender story of where I am.
Hey, Walt, we got to take a quick break. But when we come back, I want to go back to, you know, you said you were four when this whole thing kind of manifested itself. And I'd like to talk a little bit about how you were supported or not supported in that decision at that age. What was your life like and so forth at four that sent you down that road? So we're going to come right back.
Yeah, we have a million questions. We just don't know how to ask them.
Yeah.
All right.
You know, if it's a bad question, I'll just say no.
Oh, okay. That's cool. Well, we try not to be weird, but, you know, we're curious. So we are chatting with Walt Heyer, and we'll be right back. You can find all Walt's information on wethepeopleradio.us. Mm-hmm.
buildings reach up to the sky. The traffic thunders on the busy street. Pavement slips beneath my feet. I walk alone and wonder, who am I?
Nice. You are listening to We the People. We are here with Walt Heyer. And title of the article that I read that prompted me to get a hold of Walt is, I used to be transgender. Here's my take on kids who think they are transgender. And it's a story about a 9-year-old boy selling Girl Scout cookies. And I'm just going to speed to the end because that was the part where I was like, I got to find this guy. It says, the neighbor man was correct about one thing. The Girl Scout at his door was really a boy in a dress, just like I was a young boy who thought I was a girl. And, you know, it's just ripped out of the headlines. We hear this all the time. So, right. Before we went on break, Bill was asking you, Walt, a little bit more about when you were a kid.
Yeah, if we could, let's talk about if we can, when you were that age, what support or lack of support did you have to talk about your feelings and talk about you were.
Yeah, you know, it's funny. I think we expect way, way too much out of a 4-year-old kid. When you start talking about what's a kid feel like, I mean, at the age of 3 or 4 or 5, children are looking for affirmation, they're looking for love, and they're looking for feeling safe. They want to feel safe. They want to feel like they're really cared for. And in my case, I cannot tell you how it started, but I started cross-dressing at the age of 4 while I was being babysat by my grandmother at her house. And she seemed to really be much more excited about me being a girl than she ever was about me being a boy. And she focused on this, and she said, this will be our little secret. And so it became kind of what we did for nearly 2.5 years when I was babysat by my grandmother. We cross-dressed. She even made me a purple chiffon evening dress. Now, in retrospect today, looking back, what I see now is that a young child that I was, a boy, that grandma's affirming this change of gender identity by helping with making me a dress, helping me cross-dress, was actually fracturing my male gender identity. So because she seemed to love the girl so much more than she did the boy. So there was, when you talk about feelings, I was feeling much more loved as a girl than I was as a boy. So obviously that would be something I would really want to migrate toward. If I was being loved more as a girl, why wouldn't I want to be the girl? So, so therein lies the start of dysphoria. You know, I became dysphoric about my male gender identity because my grandmother did not like my male gender identity as much as she did the made up female gender identity that was purely a fantasy and as she called it, our little secret. So once you plant these seeds in a 3 or 4 year old child and then nurture that seed just like you would growing something in your garden and water it by giving it affirmation and support and even giving it some reality, you've started something that in the psyche is very, very troubling because the person then is dealing actually with the old identity and the new one that's being affirmed. So there's where the fracturing and the brokenness comes. Now, when I started out as many years ago and today there's no real healing. In California, you can't even go to a therapist and ask for help for gender identity because they've made it against the law. So, when I was young, nobody knew anything about it. I may have been one of the first, transgender kids because It was when I was cross-dressing was in 1944.
Oh, wow.
Wow. So do you think what's going on now? I mean, you're hearing now where they're passing these laws where if you feel like a girl, you can use the girl's restroom. If you feel like a boy, you can use the boy. Do you think that's kind of playing into this same psyche of
just making everybody feel confused?
Just confusing kids at that age that, you know, or down the road are going to be facing these same challenges?
Well, I'm not sure that it's confusing them. I think probably more what it's doing is affirming an ideology about the change of gender that in reality doesn't exist. Because, and I say that not because I'm trying to be abusive or harsh or anything such as that.
Well, let's face it, you're not going to be able to say anything that isn't going to be harsh to somebody on this one.
I suppose you're right.
Yeah, I say something, I don't know exactly how to word it either.
Yeah. Well, here's the thing. You know, what we do know is absolutely impossible to change somebody's gender. Now, it's not impossible to make somebody look like they changed their gender. So that's kind of where we are. Now, so I think the bathroom thing, and one of the things that sort of really caught my curiosity of late is the fact that they call the bathroom bill anti-LGBT. Well, that is so off base, it's laughable, because if you take a lesbian as an example, all lesbians know what bathrooms to go into. They're not confused about going into the women's restroom. So, you know, the L of the LGBT doesn't have a problem with any of the bathroom stuff. So then if you move to the G, which is the gay men, they don't have any trouble knowing which bathroom to go into. They know they're men, and they go into the bathroom. And then if you take the B of the LGBT, and, you know, they're not confused about their gender. They just like dealing sexually with both genders. So they go into the right biological restroom without any problem.
And I never thought about it like this.
Yeah, and the fact of the matter is that transgenders, like I was, I lived eight years as a transgender. I never had any problem knowing which restroom to go into because I was female Laura Jensen. I looked like a female. I never had any problem, never had any question about whether I was female or not. So it's not even any of the LGBT, it's not anti at all, because what the real issue is if there's a group called gender nonconforming, and it is the gender nonconformists, which make up, this is such a minuscule,
microscopic,
yeah, really,
percentage of the population. When you think that transgenders make up 0.3% of 1%, we're talking really small numbers. Now, in terms of gender nonconforming, it's a fraction. They represent a fraction of the transgender. So we're doing all of these laws to accommodate the smallest fraction of people who do not want to conform. They really do not want to conform to gender norms. And so it really isn't anti-LGBT, because the L, G, B, and T all know which bathroom to go into. That's pretty simple. But it's the people who don't want to conform to the label on the door that are causing these laws to be, erupted. So it's really odd that we would give such a small fraction of the population, it's small, and then give them the power over the entire rest of the population about who goes into what bathroom. So if we look at this, there's nothing anti-LGBT about it at all.
Yeah,
because it's all been spurned and started by people who just don't want to conform to gender norms. And those people, frankly, are not transgender, they're not lesbian, they're not gay, and they're not bisexual. They're a whole different group.
Well, they're probably
they're just people. They're just people with a solution in search of a problem.
Well, that's probably not the only thing they don't want to conform with either. I mean, let's face it; they probably don't want to conform with a bunch of different things, and that just happens to be a hot button right now.
Yeah.
Right.
Well, I have linked. I've linked a handful of articles. It was not hard to find you on the internet. At all, not difficult. There's quite a bit. And maybe when we come back from this break, you could talk to us a little bit about some of the – I was curious about the pushback that you get. Because honestly, you know, after going through all this, it seems like, you know, it would be easy to just go live your life. And instead, you became very, very public and have I'm sure helped a lot of people. But you're a voice that is – that's really rare. I just was curious if there are other people out there speaking out like you are and what kind of a reception you get, you know, everywhere. There's an article in Media Matters, and all you have to do is read down through the comment section. It's like, oh, wow, stupidity is alive and well.
Yeah.
So we'll be right back. And Walt, let me just figure out, do I say your name? Is it Hyer or Hayer?
It is Hyer, just like...
Yeah, hire you for
taxes.
A job. Sure. Like just like taxes, that's right. We should have landed on that the first time. Just wanted to make sure I was saying it properly. So we have Walt Hyer with us, and he is an author and a public speaker with a passion to help others who regret gender change. His website is sexchangeregret.com. He has a blog at walthyer.com, and you can find all of that at wethepeopleradio.us. And I hope you're listening with a pencil in your hand, because if you're not, you're going to miss everything. We'll be right back.
When I was young, it seemed that life was so wonderful. A miracle. Oh, it was beautiful, magical. And all the birds in the trees, they'd be singing so happily. Oh, joyfully. Oh, playfully, watching me. But then they sent me. Singing bird in the croaking toad. I've got a name. I've got a name. And I carry it with me like my daddy did. But I'm living the dream that he kept here. Rolling me down the highway. Rolling me down the highway.
Welcome back. You're listening to We the People Radio. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We're here with Walt Hyer, and he is now 74. He acts as a counselor to those who are considering sex change surgery and feels that the psychological vetting of patients before the operation is inadequate. And, you know, most of us can't comment on that, Walt, because we really don't know. So you're in a very small group of experts, really, but you take a lot of shots, I would imagine, for this.
Yeah, and to be honest with you, I don't counsel anybody. What I do is I provide research studies that are done by research organizations, colleges, universities, and others. I provide information to people who are considering the change and let them make their own decision about whether they feel it's going to be adequate for them or a good thing for them. But I don't I don't try to counsel them away. I just let the research work speak for that. And but most of the people that I spend time working with or talking with are the people who've gone through it, and 8, 9, 10, 15, 20 years later said, wow, this was not a good thing, and they want help. So so I don't, you know, I'm not in the discouragement business.
No.
except to provide information so people can make an informed decision, which I was not allowed to do when I was told that I needed the surgery.
Right. Well, I guess because I was reading this the Dopes at Media Matters, and it was just, the whole thing was kind of, you already explained the LGBT thing in the last segment, and so this makes their whole article basically stupid, which is like most of their stuff, but a popular right-wing activist with extreme discredited views about LGBT people is making the media rounds. It's like, okay, that whole sentence makes no sense.
Yeah, see, I don't ever read that stuff.
That's probably good.
You know, I realize that, you know, this is what they need to do, but what they don't know is that, you know, I'm a recovering alcoholic, 30 years recovery as of today, as a matter of fact.
Good for you.
And my sponsor and longtime friend is a homosexual, and among the group of people that I know, there's lesbians and others that are friends of mine. So the fact that someone would report that I'm anti, and I've been a transgender, and the fact that they're saying right. I'm anti-LGBT is just, I mean, it should be a Saturday Night Live skit rather than something that somebody could print.
That's what I mean. As I read this, I thought, wow, this isn't even close. But you had a hard road because you have kids and you were
yeah.
you were married at the well you were divorced just before you did the surgery, right?
That's correct.
I read several things, and so I don't want to get things sideways.
Yeah.
But
right.
And then you worked all that out afterward, you know, with your kids. I thought that part of there was one very long article that I've linked here on the page, and I thought your whole going back to your kids and talking to them about what you did and making and mending those fences, I guess, or building.
Right.
I thought that was great, actually. There are a lot of people whose parents should do that regardless of what they did.
Well, yeah, I think when a parent's really been very foolish and done things that have harmed their children, they need to make amends to them. And, you know, and sometimes it doesn't suffice for the children. They're still going to remain angry, but you still have to do what you can. And so I just don't want anybody else to go through what I've gone through. Everything about from my life, from my perspective, and from literally hundreds of letters that I've got from people who've gone through the surgery has convinced me that in the long run, there is really nothing good about changing genders surgically and devoting your life to being a transgender. It has long-range implications that are just not very rewarding. Now, I will say that 100% of the people at the outcome of right after surgery, they're all very happy. You know, there is this tremendous period of happiness and joy and all that stuff that goes on. For each individual, however, that fades over time. And some people, I've had them write me and tell me that it went away at 3 weeks.
Oh, wow.
And I've had some of them write me. I have one, not some. I had one specific one write me and say it was 30 years later. So anywhere in between, people come to realize that there's something about changing genders that will have a regrettable outcome. And that, I think, is a message that doesn't get out there. And the fact that if you look on the blog and you'll see that the studies show that the vast majority of people who opt for a gender change have mental disorders. None of them are, you know, wacko disorders. They're just bipolar disorder or dissociative disorder or obsessive compulsive disorder or schizophrenia. I mean, they're all treatable disorders. That's my point. I mean, I'm not trying to paint them as being a wacko population. What they really need, rather than hormones and someone chopping off body parts, is actually some good, sound psychotherapy. But now what we have is people who are writing for these other opposing views are preventing anyone from really having access to good psychotherapy that would prevent them from having surgery. So that's kind of where I come from.
So what I hear you saying is you were...
Nice job, Dr. Bill.
Yeah. The unhappiness, the unhappiness and depression that you experienced prior to your surgery went away after the surgery, but then came back a short time later. So that obviously told you that wasn't the problem. Now, how
right.
many... What's the, or do you know what the percentage of people that experience that same effect that go through what you went through, what percentage of people fall into that category?
Well, you know, there's two things that when we talk about this, that are really important for people to kind of get their head around and dialogue about. First off, the transgender population as a whole, people who claim to be transgender or self-identify as transgender, 41% of them attempt suicide. So if we look at
Yikes.
That group, 41% will attempt suicide at some point during or after their transition. So if you look at that and then say to yourself, I don't know anybody who is happy with their life that's going to try to end it by committing suicide. So if, in my view, I look at the 41% as sort of the regretters who we cannot hear from on the radio. I happen to be one of the ones who attempted suicide and didn't die, however, so you are hearing from me. But, and then I've got a blog posting on my blog that shows that somewhere around 20%, according to some study, I don't remember which one it was because it was so long ago, that about 20% of the people regret the surgery. Now, there was a doctor, Dr. Charles Ilenfeld, who was one of the original people who administered hormones and therapy to some 500 transgenders over a six-year period during the 70s. And he said that a change of gender, and this is his words, now he was a homosexual activist and doctor helping transgenders transition, and he said that changing genders, and I quote, is only a temporary reprieve and not a lifelong solution.
Mm-hmm.
So that's from him. I don't think there's any real adequate percentages that you can put on how many people regret it. But I look at the reported 41% who commit suicide, attempt suicide, as regretters. Because they must be regretting it.
So that's 41% after the surgery?
Well, it's before and after. Through
okay.
anybody who identifies at some point will have said that they had attempted suicide.
Wow. That's a huge number.
That's big.
So if there's any portion of that people who are left, then we could say that, you know, it's pretty much a crapshoot from there on out how many people are really going to benefit from it long term. And I'll reiterate that everybody thinks it's really good the first several years. For me, it was 8 years. I know people have gone as long as 20 years. So what we're seeing in the young children who are being put on television and stuff, they may be getting a lot of affirmation right now, but we really don't know what the long-term outcome, if it's actually going to be beneficial to them to have been given TV shows and given such media focus or not, that still remains an open question.
Yeah, you know, and with this, nobody can say no to anything, and we've got to accept everything no matter, you know, what it is. And I'm sure there are a segment of parents out there that think, well, I'm afraid to mess up my kid by telling him that this isn't reality, and you're not allowed to go to a counselor and sort that out in the state of California anyway. Is that common across the country, or is that just out here with us crazy people?
Well, it's starting to work its way through many segments of the country, but I think there's some people in different places that are starting to wake up to the fact and kind of learn that, you know, there's also a study that's on my blog that shows if we leave the children alone, 94% of them would actually grow out of their gender dysphoria if we just didn't encourage them toward a gender change.
Oh. If you just let them grow up.
Yeah, you just, you know,
imagine that.
You don't buy them a dress, you don't get them little pink pumps, and you don't send them off to school and affirm that they're really somebody they're not. And, you know, I know that's not very popular, but the studies and everything that I say, I can back up with a university or some organization, so I'm not just speaking off the cuff or trying to be harsh or anything else.
Right.
There's studies out there, and there's life stories like mine that back it up.
Well, when you grew up, was there much of a male influence in your life as a young child?
Yeah. I was sexually molested by my uncle.
Oh, well, that's not a good male
that's
influence.
Not exactly the influence I was looking for.
Yeah, and that's from the people who write me, there's a pretty good, not every one of them, but there's a pretty good percentage of people who are transgender that were molested or sexually abused as a young child.
Wow.
Well, see, that just goes back to your conclusion that they really need some psychological help. And now we've prevented that. Isn't that smart of us? We need to take one last quick break. We'll be back with Walt. To finish off our thoughts, we have a lot of people asking if you were an only child and if you have brothers and sisters and, if, you know, all these things. You know, everybody's curious about all this. So maybe you could give us some rapid-fire information when we come back.
I can do that. I can do rapid-fire.
We can do Walt Lightning Round. You're listening
there
to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. We'll be right back.
You give your hand to me and then you say hello. I can hardly speak, my heart is beating so, and anyone can tell, you think you know me well, but you don't know me.
If it makes you happy, it can't be that bad, if it makes
Welcome back. You're rejoining We the People Radio. We are here with Walt Heyer. Okay, Walt. So, what are some other things people need to know that we haven't that we just don't know to ask you?
Well, yeah. I mean, when at the break you asked me if I had a brother. Yes, I do. He was raised or babysat by a different grandmother in a different part of Los Angeles, so he didn't have the same experience I did. And so it was a rather shock to him to learn what my grandmother did. In fact, he just can't believe it. You know, he didn't have the uncle experience. He didn't have my experience. And my uncle molested me because he found out that my grandmother had been cross-dressing me, and he thought that was, you know, I was a good target because I was a boy wearing a dress. So everything evolved from grandma cross-dressing me and making that dress. But if you want the story, because I'm self-supporting in all that I do, the book
Oh, that's right. I forgot.
Kid Dakota and the Secret at Grandma's House tells the story. And then if you want more research information, the book Paper Genders, which is sold worldwide and has been reprinted in Italian and published in Italy, is a great book for resource information, as well as the other books. So more detail can be found in those books.
That's terrific. I did see that, and my bad, I did not link those. I linked a lot of links and put a couple articles on, but I will put your book links on there because that's a great idea. For people who just, you know, don't know anything about this topic, maybe don't have anybody in their family who's dealing with this that they know of, how can they be helpful? Like, for us huddled masses out here that are going, is the world gone crazy?
Yeah, I it's very difficult to be helpful to people who are confused and struggle themselves. I would just plead with people to get informed so that when they talk about it, they're not reading off the LGBT playlist about what this is, because there's more than one playlist, and so there is a lot of studies that refute all the claims that the LGBT makes about transgender. So, that's my plea is for people. I always tell people, get educated. Don't take my word for it. Read the studies. That's why I've put so many studies in all my books. I link to all the studies so that it's not my word speaking. I'm more of a person who's pointing people to the studies rather than me making some outlandish claim. It's the research information that gives us the information that tells us there's something wrong. And this guy that did this, Dr. Hillenfeld in the late 70s said that he left giving hormone therapy and helping people change genders because he said there is too many suicides and too much unhappiness among the people changing genders, so I'm going to study psychiatry, and he became a psychiatrist. He's still a practicing psychiatrist up in New Jersey.
Uh-oh. Bob?
Hello?
Oh, there we go.
Oh, there we are.
It got really quiet there for a second. It was like...
Yeah, so did you get that?
Yep. Sorry. I think the NSA must have gotten a little scramble going on their tape.
It's really about educating people. People can't help someone if they're not well-informed about it. All they can do is follow what the TV is telling them. And, you know, and the TV is doing what we call... There's a psychological term for it. It's called flooding. And desensitizing by having ABC as an example, over 50% of their primetime content is LGBT oriented.
So yes, we've noticed.
When you have a population of LGBT comprised 3.4% of the total population, and then on television they have over 50% of LGBT content, you know that we're being brainwashed.
Absolutely. And you know, there are a lot of us out there who think that, but it, you know, we're kind of not allowed to say it. But it's nice to get a little confirmation on this because it feels like sometimes we're living in crazy town.
Yeah. Well, you are.
And we got that from the expert.
Yeah, there you go.
Hey, thanks for taking time out of your travels today to chat with us. We'd love to have you back, especially if you'd like to promote one of the books in a little more detail or any of that.
Sure.
Thanks very much. We really...
thanks for being on, Walt. It was very, very, very interesting.
We've waded into water that was brand new for us.
Well, good. I'm glad I could do it. Thank you for allowing me the privilege to be on and speak about it and an effort to really help people. I'm not trying to hurt anybody at all.
Absolutely. Thanks a million. Folks, you can find all the information about Walt Heyer on our site, wethepeopleradio.us, his blog, links, and books.
Uh-huh.
afternoon. Welcome to the second hour of We the People Radio. I'm Aaron Ryan.
And I'm Bill Cundiff.
And Jared doesn't know that we have him say his name, so he's Jared.
Yeah, I'm Jared.
Yeah. he's not Bob.
I'd give you Jared's last name, but I don't know it. It's a secret. He's Jared sitting in Bob's chair. Bob's at a baseball game? I think Bob's at a baseball game.
I'm not sure. He didn't actually tell me why he was taking
Yeah, I think he said it was a baseball game. Yeah. Are there baseball games playing somewhere far away?
I wouldn't be the guy to ask.
Yeah, I know. Me either, obviously.
I'm a big fan.
We're obviously all professional sports fanatics.
Absolutely.
Not. So let's see. The first hour today, we played you an archive from May. I hope you liked it. I thought it was a lot of good, interesting information that you don't hear in the mainstream media from a guy that can definitely tackle the subject and, I don't know, call him an expert. How's that? So, second hour today, we're talking about the excessive class action attorneys' fees. What do you call them, class action things where, you know, you send in your postcard and then you get 12 cents back,
yeah,
like 10 years later.
In fact, I think we got 30 cents here not too long ago. In the mail. We won. We were happy.
Yeah, you win. You get 30 cents.
Hey, you've been successful.
So, our guest today, Lawrence Schombrun, we've had him on before. I believe it was in April. I'll have to look. For whatever reason, I did not attach that show, but I will for you. And he is a nationally recognized authority on the issue of reasonableness of attorney's fees awards and class actions. He's appeared on behalf of unnamed class... Whoops. Don't touch the screen while you're reading it. I just committed the touch screen error. You touch it, it gets really big. Then you can only see one word at a time. Not good. He's appeared on behalf of unnamed class members in approximately 200 class actions throughout the United States. A New York native, now living in Northern California, he received his undergraduate degree from the University of Vermont, nice place, in 1966, and his law degree from Boston College of Law in 1969. So, let's see, he's been on Stossel. I kept meaning to go look that up. We should link those because I bet that was a fun show. It was called The Trouble with Lawyers, as well as Morley Safer 60 Minutes, called The Disaster That Wasn't. So we've been waiting on this California Supreme Court ruling, and that's now in. So we're going to kind of talk a little bit about what it was all about and then what happened. You get the whole story today. So, Lawrence, where do you want to start?
Yes.
Where do you want to start?
I think I'd like to start with the two issues that I raised in this case and their history in the state of California, and then get into what the court said, and then we can follow it up by talking about some of the problems and some of the outrageous amounts of money that lawyers are being given from these class action settlements. The two issues that were involved in my case, Lafitte, were, number one, whether the trial courts could use the percentage approach in awarding fees as opposed to using an approach that bases the award on what the lawyers did, how many lawyers worked on the case, what their hourly rates were, what they did. In the 1970s, there was a revolt, I would say, against these percentages because they were wound up awarding lawyers outrageous sums of money in general, and particularly outrageous when you looked at them as a function of how much they were getting an hour for what they did. Although Serrano, I believe, said you had to base the fee on the work the lawyer did, several courts weren't abiding by that. And I had a case out of L.A. County where the judge awarded 33 1/3% of the classes. It was a $19 million settlement.
Wow.
So the lawyers wanted $6 million in fees that worked out to $1,500 per hour.
Huh.
So I argued to that court, to the Court of Appeals, which rejected my argument as well. But the Supreme Court took the case because
at a minimum, there was a dispute about whether California courts could use percentages. The second issue that I raised, which, by the way, applies across the United States as well, had to do with this problem in class actions where the class is unrepresented. What happens, you know, the court appoints a lawyer to represent the class. Individual class members have no knowledge of the case, have executed no agreement with the lawyer about how much he's going to take. So when the lawyer is suing the defendant and trying to reach a settlement, he's representing the class because all that money that he gets from the defendant is the class recovery. But then what happens at the fee-setting stage, the lawyer's not only no longer representing the class, he's actively against the class because he's trying to get a fee, which means he's trying to reduce the class's recovery. At that point, the class has no representation. The lawyer files declarations. There's no lawyer representing the class. The lawyer introduced experts. There's no experts being introduced to represent the class. So I argued that the court, under due process, because you're taking away the property of these class members, their money, that under due process the court had an obligation to appoint a class guardian so that there was a lawyer on both sides of the issue. Well, an interesting thing happened in this case. The most interesting aspect of this case is that it may mark a sort of, I don't know if the word is revolution, but certainly a turning point in the way we should look at the courts. The law prior and at the time of Serrano, California case, was number one, that when courts set fees for lawyers, it involves the prestige of the courts, the prestige of the bar, and it's linked to the public's confidence in our judicial system. Another legal principle at that time was when the courts allowed a lawyer to represent a whole group of people and he recovered some money for that group, the courts in calculating fees had to exercise moderation and their focus had to be on the rights of those interested in the fund, class members. The third principle was or is that the court acts as a fiduciary for the class, meaning the court's first and paramount and only interest is the benefiting the class members. So none of those three legal principles is mentioned in this decision. So the California Supreme Court from here on out for this next century, shall we say, has abandoned the notions of the prestige of the courts and the bar being involved in this process, made no mention, rejected the idea that the courts are fiduciaries for the class members, and rejected the idea that moderation should guide their fee awards. They mentioned, although I argued that and wrote that in my brief, their majority opinion mentions nothing about it. On the question of this conflict of interest between the lawyers and the class members, again, the California Supreme Court ignored the issue. They were totally silent. So the way I read this is that those principles that I spoke to you about are sort of principles of a bygone era, and now the courts have openly rejected their role of representing the interests of class members, of instilling confidence in the public about what goes on in courts. And the focus of this court's attention was the lawyers. And how do we incentivize lawyers to litigate cases efficiently? And how do we make less work for judges?
Wow.
Those were the two principles that guided this most recent Lafitte decision.
Unbelievable. And so,
yes.
So we're going to keep getting 12-cent checks from class actions, I guess, is the long and the short of it, huh?
Well, not only that. Okay, so more important than that, yes, I mean, that's true, but they're not particularly ashamed about that.
No, obviously but not. They decided to continue it. I mean, what the heck? Hold on one second, and let's take a really quick break. I think what we're going to do is call you right back and see if we can clear up the line a little bit. We have quite a bit of crackliness going on.
Oh, boy.
So we'll see if we can fix the crackliness.
Can I hang up then and you'll call me back?
Oh, sure. Sure, we'll do it all while the commercials are playing and nobody will be the wiser, except maybe we'll have a better connection. How'd that be?
Okay.
So
we're
here chatting about lawsuit abuse. You know, I think everybody's been involved in some kind of class action, even if it was a mindless little postcard you got in the mail that said, hey, you bought a product a year ago and they're suing about it. And if you send it back, you might get something out of it. But I'd kind of like to know from Lawrence, maybe next in the next segment or so, what happens when you really have you're really part of a class action, you were harmed by something. You think about all the really big cases that have gone on with chemical companies and, you know, water pollution type stuff and things like that. And you may wind up getting taken to the cleaners as well. We will be right back. You're listening to We the People. Join us online, wethepeopleradio.us. That silent part where you were listening to a little extra music was Bill pointing at me, trying to make me talk.
Yeah, I was twisting.
It's not as fun on radio as it is in person.
Spit it out.
You can't make me talk.
I'm making you talk.
Okay, so Lawrence, what about those postcards? I think we talked about that last time, but
we did.
What about these people that are actually really harmed? They all work in a place that had asbestos in the ceiling tiles or whatever, and they're all really sick. Those people are all going to get gypped too. I mean, those of us who get a check for 15 cents and don't even know why, I guess I don't feel so sorry for us, but what about the folks that are in these class action things that are really...
Yeah, is it better to not join a class action in cases where you might do better if you go out on your own, although you might be talking about huge attorney fees, but you might get something out of the deal?
Well, I mean, typically, if the case involves a personal injury, that it is worth having an individual lawyer. But the class actions have become so ubiquitous that now they will basically amalgamate all individual personal injury lawsuits into one, you know, tort, which... even if they're for significant sums of money, they get handled in the manner of a class action.
Mm.
But the focus, my focus is not so much on how little money the class members are getting, but in the context of that, how much money the lawyers are getting.
Right.
And in my case, as I say, it was $1,500 an hour, and that's for thousands of hours of work. Another case I'm familiar with, the lawyers got $7,800 an hour, again, for thousands of hours of work. I cited in my brief a legal authority who said that there's anecdotal evidence in the kind of cases you're talking about, mass torts, that lawyers are getting in excess, can get in excess of $10,000 an hour.
Wow.
So these are incredible sums of money that the courts are dishing out. And one of the particularly bad aspects of the recent California Supreme Court decision, that there are some courts that will use a percentage, but they will also use what's called the lodestar. They will ask the lawyers to talk about, you know, what hours they put into the case, what they did, how many lawyers were involved. It's called a cross-check. And it exists in many federal courts. The California Supreme Court went out of its way to say, we're not going to require courts to do a lodestar cross-check. So that means on an hourly basis, the public will never find out how much work was put into these cases, because under the percentage approach, the amount of work is irrelevant, and there's no requirement of a lodestar cross-check. They're leaving that totally to the discretion of the judge, which is leaving it basically to the lawyers for the most part. And where the lawyers didn't work so hard on the case, and therefore the hourly rate is in the thousands of dollars an hour, which, parenthetically, you know, in this recent presidential race, the normal people are fighting for $15 or $20 an hour. These lawyers are getting thousands of dollars an hour, but we'll never know, because the evidence is going to be hidden, because the Supreme Court says it doesn't need to be disclosed.
Wow.
So there's nothing in place in California then for anybody to check or require the lawyers to disclose what their fees are going into the case. They can just arbitrarily assign any amount?
Well, when you say going into the case, I need to explain that class actions, unlike your typical tort situation, the fee is not determined until after the case is settled.
Uh-huh.
Yes, it is true that the one person representing the class may agree to a fee, but that's not particularly relevant to what the judge is going to decide. So the fees are not known going into the case, arguably because the lawyers would like to see which way they can make more money. If it was a particular, if they spent a lot of time or claimed they spent a lot of time and didn't get a lot of money in settlement, then maybe they'd prefer the lodestar amount of work done. But if the amount is very high, the settlement amount's very high, and the time is not that is not commensurate, so they prefer to have a percentage. And as I say, in California, there's no cross-check. We'll never know.
No,
I mean,
kidding.
This is really a gift by the California Supreme Court to the plaintiff's lawyers, and an abandonment of a role that's been a tradition for over 130 years. It's really quite astounding what the court has done.
And so, in other states, just to kind of give a comparison around the country,
right,
is this unique, or is this kind of following a trend, or setting a trend?
To be candid with you, it is following a trend. Well, there are two parts here. The use of the percentage, the use of, let's say, if I can use the term, a naked percentage, is not particularly a trend. The federal court system, for example, encourages, or I think encourages is the word, a lodestar cross-check. I'm not sure about what, I know some states don't allow percentages. I'm thinking Florida, Massachusetts, and I believe Texas, but many states do. But I need to explain to you why, indeed, that trend does exist. Because as I told you, 30 years ago, the courts were concerned about excessive fees. Now they're not. And how that trend exists is another corruption of the legal system. What these plaintiff class action lawyers did was basically engage in a campaign to have courts get rid of basing the fee on work and just base it on a fixed percentage. And what they've been able to do is hire academicians, law professors mainly, from well-known law schools who over the last 30 years have argued on their behalf and are paid by them to argue that courts should use the percentage approach. They also now have taken to hiring retired judges. This now becomes a plum assignment for a judge who's retired to get hired by one of these plaintiff action law firms to speak in favor of the fee request. In my case, I think there were 12. There were 12 law professors from throughout the country, good law, good rated law schools, who they've been using for 20 and 30 years, and they used them in this case. So this trend is, to me, a phony trend that they've created by abusing the system by using these law professors and these retired judges. I mean, there are a couple of caveats I might add. And these expert witnesses act as criminal lawyers in a sense. Let me explain to you what I mean. I once asked one of these professors, this is not a specific example, but I asked him, how can you say that these lawyers are entitled to $300 million in fees for working in this case? He says, I don't believe that. I said, what do you mean you don't believe that? He said, you just filed a declaration and said they were entitled to $300 million. So he said to me, I'm working as a lawyer here. I'm not saying I believe this. I'm saying I can provide a legal justification for it. So that's the sense I mean that, a criminal lawyer doesn't necessarily believe the client's innocent, but he's allowed to present a defense. So the system has really, it's become corrupted, and now with this new California Supreme Court, they seem to be openly siding with this special interest group of lawyers against the common citizenry. Because these fees in the end are paid for by consumers.
Right.
They're paid for in the price of products, what we get, what we don't get. So this is an example of, they call it regulatory capture in other areas where you have these regulatory commissions are supposed to regulate businesses, but they wind up being co-opted and captured and mouthing the interests of the businesses. And I will say, I've heard it's true also that after they leave the regulatory commission, then they wind up being hired by the people they were regulating.
There's
an economic motive there. But that seems to be, people I think wouldn't think the court system operated that way. But
it's supposed to be followed
by other states. But this is what's happened now in California, which has the reputation for reform, the reputation for being a trendsetter.
Or not.
or not.
In this particular case, yet again, or not. We have to take a really quick break. We'll be back with Lawrence Schombrun. We're talking about the recent California Supreme Court ruling, and for some reason I neglected to actually post that ruling, but I'll do that during the break for you.
Thank you.
You can find it at wethepeopleradio.us, and we'll be right back. And get all the monies in there because California Supreme Court, I should be more specific, said definitely all the money should go to the lawyers. Super
right.
important on those class
That's
action
right.
cases. Let's just drive that cost up through the roof so those consumers can pay for it.
Yeah.
Bill, you had a
Lawrence, I had a question on,
question.
You know, they said that, or they've changed it now to where they get a percentage of the,
right.
of the, fee, but has that percentage changed much since that ruling, or is this is it pretty much a standard percentage everywhere?
That's a very good question.
Good job,
I would just rephrase it this way.
Oh, except for that.
You know, when an individual hires a lawyer or law firm because they've been in an auto accident, let's say, you've probably heard 33 1/3%.
Right.
The lawyer gets a third. Now, that's one person, one law firm. What they have done, the lawyers and the professors they hire, they've taken that analogy, which is has no bearing to a class action, where you can have thousands and millions of class members and dozens of law firms, and these cases more or less have to settle because they're too big to go to trial. So the answer is that they've taken over these percentages and put them in a totally inapplicable context. And I can tell you this, but this is going back a ways. When the common fund doctrine was first established in the United States, the percentage awarded in that case was, I think, either 5 or 10%. I will say that in California prior to 1977, so that would be, let's say, in the 50s and 40s, the percentages were, They varied. Some of them were 25. I don't know if any of that was 33. They were 15, 20, and 25. So they've definitely ratcheted up to 33 1/3%. But they were in this very inapplicable range before Serrano. And in fact, that's the reason why Serrano came to exist. Because in all these cases throughout the country, the lawyers were using this 25, 33 1/3% or whatever to get these outrageous fees for not with work that wasn't commensurate. So this was a way to change that negative experience.
Yeah, it just seems like there's got to be a more fair way to calculate a fair fee for what they do. I mean, typically in business, as the price of a product goes up, the percentage of profit comes down. You buy a 10-cent stick of gum, it costs, 0.01 cent to produce, but you buy a house and your real estate agent is going to get 6%. Groceries is, 30, 40%. So why don't they take that into consideration?
Well, because number one, the court system has its own logic. Number two, the lawyers have taken control, and I'm talking about plaintiff class action lawyers. They have taken control of the process. They've now taken it. Class members, you remember, have no right to complain. They're not involved in the process. The judges now have ceded their responsibility. So it's a rudderless enterprise with the lawyers running the ship. And that's why it is the way it is. The issue is below the radar of most people. And another problem we haven't spoken about is when you're giving, millions, tens of millions, hundreds of millions of dollars to lawyers, you're giving them incredible power in our society, be it through money that's given to politicians and judges in campaigns, or just the ability to hire these experts who can say they're from Harvard and Yale and University of Chicago. And they have now, I've used the term now plutocracy. It's more to me a naked show of power by special interests against we the people.
Right.
We're entering, it could be, I don't know, but from my perspective in the law, we're entering this dark period where they say the inmates are running the asylum.
Right.
The judges, the California court system has ceded its supervisory authority to the lawyers seeking fees. And as the lawyers could say, judge, give us a third and you won't have to do much work calculating. And then the judges have said to the lawyers, how much money will it take to incentivize you to handle these cases? That's what now has replaced moderation, prestige, and fiduciary responsibility. They've thrown these concepts out. I don't know if another state is going to read this and be revulsed by it and want to change things, but we know that California typically leads the nation, doesn't follow. But you did make a point, and in this opinion, the California court did say, we join the trend.
Right, right.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah. You brought up another interesting point. If you want to be an attorney, you have to go to law school. You have to pass all your classes and everything, and you have to pass the bar exam. Why then, if they all take the same bar exam and they all have to pass it by a certain score, why then does the Harvard guy get more money than the guy that goes to johnsmith.com law school online? They all pass the same test. Why such a huge discrepancy in fees?
That's a complicated question. Are you asking this in the context of class actions or when just a lawyer goes to work?
Exactly. Yeah. More just the attorney perspective.
Well, I mean, what I can tell you is that when lawyers are hired by private firms, the lawyers who do outstandingly well at the most prestigious law firms, at the most prestigious law schools, get the most money. Now, why that is, I have to assume that these people are smart, and the law firms are looking for smart people.
So it's not the same curriculum at a Harvard law school versus a smaller college. Not the same curriculum, not the same tests and so forth?
Well, in terms of the bar exams, you know, I don't, it's a good question. I don't know if there's ever been a correlation between who passes the bar exam with what scores and what law schools they went to.
Right.
I don't know that there's ever been a correlation in that way. But I mean, I think it's true of, I mean, let's look at radio talk show hosts, what you're doing. Wouldn't you agree that there are people who, you know, in your opinion, not being biased, are very good at what they do, some are sort of okay at what they do, and others
don't
do a good job.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, you know, that, and to the extent that correlates to background, education, and experience, that's part of what goes into how lawyers are rated in terms of what they charge. But there's no rule about it. It's kind of whatever you can get.
It's whatever the market will bear. Tell me, it's kind of like what the market will bear. I mean, if people think, if people feel that there's more value there, they'll pay for it. But I was curious, with this whole thing, would, if you took a class action, say for instance, and you won, and there were millions of dollars on the line, do you have the ability to say, hey, look, it's inappropriate for me to get, you know, $5 million. I'm going to take my regular fee and the rest goes back to the participants of the class action? Can you
I mean, the lawyers set their own fees.
Okay.
Of course they have the right to do that.
So they could do the right thing if they wanted to. They could do the right thing if they wanted to.
Of course, of course. But, I mean, arguably we live in an age where you know, richness, getting rich is sort of what's the ideal. And there's no gatekeeper there. As I say, the judiciary has given up its role of being a gatekeeper policing these fees.
Yeah, that is just such a bad idea. We need to take a really quick break and get a word in from Donna Summer, it looks like we're going to have here.
Okay.
Nice, Jared. We'll be right back. You're listening to We the People. We're on with Lawrence Schaumbrum. He'll be right back at the last 15 minutes or so, and we'll talk to you then. Listening to the California court system operate. This is what's going on in the back room.
Next.
Those little coin noises. Okay, they're going to say money in a minute, but it takes a while. Pink Floyd and those darn lead-ins. We get all jacked up. And Lawrence, you know, just for the record, we're volunteers, so we're complete idiots in the eyes of all the class action lawyers and the judges.
I see.
We still work for free. So, what can people, obviously they can't do a lot about this at this point, since you've already tried to fight it and you've gone up through the California Supreme Court, but for those people that are going, hey, wait a second, this is driving up the cost of everything and all that, and would like to do something, got any ideas for them?
Yeah. One thing they can really do is when you, I can't speak to the success of this, but this really is an activist position, is everyone gets those notices in the mail. You mentioned at the beginning of the show that you had gotten one for $13 or 13 cents.
I think it was like 13 cents, actually.
If you read through the notice, it says, if you feel this fee, if you don't agree with the fee the lawyer is asking. Now, of course, if it's in another state, it's another issue, but oftentimes, or when it's near you, you can just show up in court. Actually, you probably have to file a paper saying you're going to be there, but you write a letter. You don't have to file a paper. You write a letter for the judge. You say, I don't agree with this. I want to come into court and complain.
As part of the class action.
I went to the Supreme Court to complain, and they didn't want to hear it at all. No, it's not a simple answer. If it were, we wouldn't be in this position. The lawyers are doing this are very smart. They're very rich. They're very powerful.
And they're going to stay that way, obviously. Now
they own the legislature, and they run things. And they're running this one for their benefit.
How long have you been fighting this?
20 years.
Just out of curiosity, what started it?
Oh, boy. What started it was I wrote an article for California Lawyer Magazine. I called it Timekeepers Without Watches, Law Firm Billing Practices, and the Corporate Consumer. And I called, I think, 20 or 30 managing partners of law firms. I called 20 or 30 corporate counsel and asked them about billing practices. And I was astounded what these corporate counsel told me about how they were being overbilled by law firms. A lawyer read my article and had a class action. And the class action, as I just mentioned, says if you think the fees are too high, come in and you can object to them. They asked me, would I like to do it? I felt uniquely qualified because I had written this article and spoken to so many people about what's going on with billing. And when I went in, I realized that I was the first person in the country to start doing this.
Interesting.
And I was the only person who was fighting for the class members. And it was a cause that I thought was worthwhile, that I thought the court system would rectify in the end, because one has this naive image about, you know, the judges are there to promote justice and the judges have no particular reason to overpay the lawyers and the judges care about the general public. So I thought, I had no idea what I was getting into. I've learned more about the court system in America than I would have ever hoped to know being involved in a regular practice. But then I started flying around the country. I've been in from California to New York, from, let's say, Chicago to Texas, appearing in, I don't know how many, you know, 30 different courts, maybe 200 cases.
Wow.
So I began to see this picture developing of what was going on that was taking advantage of the citizens, and I didn't like it, so I wanted to try to do something about it.
Well, good for you. Do you think if you could find a few states that would roll the fees back on these and make them more commensurate with the workload and make them like they should be. If you
yep.
had a few states that would go that direction, do you think it could domino and force the rest? Or once California and some of the other big ones kind of dig in, it's a pretty much, you know, a done deal?
Well, my guess is that the kind of, just speculating, the kinds of states, you know, what's coming to mind, and this probably isn't even true, it's my naivete, but let's say a state like Oregon or a state like Vermont or Rhode Island, let's say, you know, they seem, I mean, I have no facts here, but they seem like smaller states,
sure.
more connected to the people, you know, not big city politics, that if they would be the ones most likely to do it, make the changes, but there'd be no reason that large powerful states, basically where lawyers have such force and interest, would go along with it.
Mm. Well, people used to tell me,
you know, what's going to change this? And I thought, well, a financial crisis. And then 2009 came along, and it got worse. So now I'm using the term financial catastrophe. I think a financial catastrophe could change this, but I'm not sure anything short of that will.
Well, you said it earlier, the lobbyists, for tort reform are a very powerful group. Or for non-reform,
I mean,
I should
against
say. Against tort reform is a powerful group, and to get, past them is definitely
impossible.
It's an uphill battle all the way.
Yeah, but I mean, from my perspective, I mean, no one's talking about this, but I can tell people about this as a benefit of what I've been doing, because they say I know where the bodies are buried, I know where the skeletons are, I know what's going on here, so I can explain to people something that is otherwise opaque to most people. So that's what I'm trying to do.
Right, right.
Sure, because most of us, the only connection that the bulk of people have with class action is, seriously, the little postcards or the check for less than a dollar. And it's all a big mystery,
Yes.
Well, how?
And
how
they want to keep it that way.
Exactly. I mean, it's pretty easy to keep us in the dark.
The Supreme Court said, in the sense that we're not going to make you say how much an hour you got for this case. We're not going to make you say what work you did on the case. It's only going to be based on a percentage of the settlement. So the court system wants it to stay a mystery.
Interesting. And what about the corporations that are having to fork out these gigantic sums of money? You'd think that they'd have a little bit of an interest in, driving this down, or does that just guarantee that they'll get punished if they get hauled into court?
Yeah, there are a couple of answers to that. Legally, once they give the money over to the class, they have no more financial interest.
Mm.
Secondly, and this makes it even worse in a way, what the plaintiff's lawyers will do is ask the defendants to agree to the fee, even though the defendants have no interest in it. The defendants pay the money over to the class. They're not paying the fee. The class is paying the fee. But one has to believe what happens is that they work out a deal where the defendant gets something it wants for agreeing to say that the lawyers can take this money out of the settlement and they won't object. So they've got all the bases covered.
Wow. It's a perfect scenario. It's like those movies where they're walking through the, through the jungle, and then all of a sudden there's a net with some leaves over it.
Yeah.
Well, the defendants have
come,
when I started, this was novel. Now the defendants, they're all part of this large game. I mean, they're happy with the way it's going. They're not. The only problem is when the lawyers get overpaid, it encourages them to sue more companies. But the problem is a typical company gets sued once or twice. They make their bargain with the devil, and it's over.
Right.
Yeah, everybody's looking to just dodge the bullet.
Interest there for the companies did used to get together, but I think now that they've come to grips with this, paying off a class action lawsuit is like paying off a very large electric bill or who knows what.
Yeah.
In other words, it's a cost of doing business.
Divorcing that first bad wife.
Well, Lawrence, thank you very much for coming on. We've learned a lot.
Thanks a million.
Thank you.
And we link the.
I appreciate you allowing me to speak to your listeners.
Absolutely. And we link the May 8th program for those who want the beginning of the story.
Oh, great. Thank you.
All right. We will chat with you again. You've been listening to We the People Radio. You can find us online, wethepeopleradio.us.